You're listening to the Hippie Haven Podcast. I'm Callie, and it's my life mission to provide you with the tools and resources you need to spark positive change in your community. Just over 3 years ago, I started Bestowed Essentials, which has now grown to be South Dakota's largest handmade soap company, though we do make a variety of other beauty and cleaning products. Bestowed Essentials has been recognized by FedEx as one of their top 100 small businesses for 2 years in a row. My team and I also opened the Hippie Haven Shop, an online zero-waste store with a physical store in South Dakota, and of course I also host this Hippie Haven podcast. If you're new here, I release an episode most Wednesdays, which you can get instantly downloaded to your phone for easy listening by subscribing to this podcast on any of the major podcasting apps. The show notes and full transcript for every episode are available on my website, hippiehavenpodcast.com. You can also learn more about me on the website or by following along on Instagram at hippiehavenshop. Before we get started, a word from today's sponsor. Green Century Capital Management is proud to be the home of the first family of fossil fuel-free, responsible, and diversified mutual funds in the U.S., by investing in responsible corporations, Green Centuries enables individuals to align their investments with their values. Green Century also hosts an award-winning shareholder advocacy program that directly presses dozens of companies every year on sustainability practices. Green Century is the only mutual fund company in the U.S. wholly owned by environmental and public health nonprofits, and 100% of the profits earned after the Green Century Fund's fees and expenses belong to them. Learn more about investing with Green Century by visiting greencentury.com. Thank you so much to the Green Century team for sponsoring today's episode. It helps us continue to provide this free podcast for all of you. My guest today is Ayana Young, a podcast and radio personality specializing in intersectional environmental and social justice, deep ecology, and land-based restoration. With an undergraduate degree from Loyola Marymount University, including a double major in art, history, and theology, and a minor in philosophy, as well as education through Columbia University in ecology and Eastern religions, plus restoration ecology at the University of Victoria, Young has a strong academic background at the intersections of ecology, culture, and spirituality. Postgraduate dividends from her early career allowed Ayana to conserve 500 acres of coastal redwood and salmon habitat in Northern California, where she's been living for over 5 years, the first few years in a tent with no electricity or running water as she established a homestead and broke ground on a native species nursery and research center. Ayana Young is also the founder and executive director of Millennial Media Organization and nonprofit For the Wild. In today's episode, we're talking about her background in environmental activism, how to maintain and even further develop our sustainability practices during these unprecedented times, and how we hope the world will change for the better through revolutionary healing. So I would love to learn more about your story. You've had such a rich, amazing background so far, and I'd love to hear how you got started down this life path.
Yeah, goodness. I feel like so many things led me to where I am now. But yeah, I've mentioned to other folks who have wondered how I got to where I got that I did not come from a childhood raised in the wild or amongst a lot of nature. I didn't camp growing up. So it wasn't something that, oh, you may hear my dog bark.
That's okay.
This is real life, real Ayana. It wasn't something that I would say born into, although I was a really sensitive child, and I think that I knew a lot more than I understood. I look back through my mom's boxes that she kept in my childhood, and I remember finding poetry I wrote in elementary school talking about the suffering of the world. And I thought that was really interesting because I really didn't know how I knew that. Maybe through the classroom we were learning about the Amazon being logged or something. And I mentioned that in my sadness and my overwhelm and just the shallowness of this culture. I actually used those words. So clearly something inside of me, that sensitive empathic side, knew something was wrong. And in high school, I was following that thread of that that something wasn't right here feeling. And I started watching documentaries like Michael Moore's documentaries and Super Size Me and documentaries about factory farming. And those were things that really started to open me up more. But I didn't know how to take that rage, that passion, that interest, that curiosity, and actually do something with it. So, you know, college came around and I was studying the humanities and art history and philosophy and theology. And in those classes, I remember questioning capitalism and questioning power and the distribution of wealth and power. But again, like, I still didn't have an outlet where I could really take those deep belief systems and put them to work. It wasn't until Occupy Wall Street came around. And that was just the fire starter. You know, I feel like maybe I had the kindling and I had the paper and I had my lighter, or maybe Occupy was the lighter to my kindling, something like that. I don't exactly know the right metaphor, but I went there so excited to finally maybe be around people physically that wanted to talk about this stuff, because in my family life and even with some of my friends, nobody really wanted to talk about climate change. And this was a decade, this is more than a decade ago. Nobody really was interested in talking about climate change or the Anthropocene extinction or really factory farming, recycling issues, pollution. I would always bring them up at parties or at holidays or just hanging around people. And I remember being like, oh, Hayana, like, you're always Chicken Little thinking the sky is falling, or you're always, you know, you're always a downer. And I remember feeling really lonely and really, just kind of feeling like I would hit dead ends because nobody really wanted to think about these things. And so at least the people around me. And so Occupy was this incredible place where people were so revved up and ready and excited. And the energy was just palpable with how much people cared. And here I was, this person who really cared, and finally finding others who wanted, were not just willing to sit in the conversations, but wanted to be having these conversations. And so that was, I would say, the moment that my life never looked the same, because I became a political organizer basically overnight, starting the environmentalist working group at Occupy. And then I quit my job. I dropped out of grad school and I never went back. I never went back to something other than being a full-time activist. In between that time after Occupy, I went down to Patagonia, which was very wild and remote, and I was listening to what were podcasts, but at the time I didn't really understand what a podcast was, but I was kind of getting inspired to do something like that, which later, you know, the For the Wild podcast was born, and my love of wild places was born right after Occupy. And, you know, and then I moved out into the woods after leaving New York City, and I feel like there was just all these other experiences that added to the big soup of my life. And now here I am, haven't looked back. There hasn't been a day that's gone by that I have wished I wasn't doing this or something like that. You know, I'm so devoted to this work, and I feel extremely grateful and very blessed to have found this path and to be really certain in it.
I know that I have a lot of younger listeners, actually, who might not, may have heard of Occupy Wall Street, but maybe not entirely understand what that movement was about. Can you go into a little bit more detail about the efforts of Occupy Wall Street?
Yeah, of course. So Occupy Wall Street was back in 2011. And, you know, I think what the economic crash of 2008, I think it was around 2008 when the housing market crashed and they had the big bailout of Wall Street. And so there were so many people, and in a sense, kind of similar to what's happening right now with COVID-19, where the economy is crashing and the government is wanting to bail out big oil and airlines and things like that. They're wanting to give most of the bailout money to the corporations rather than the everyday person. And so a lot of Occupy Wall Street was literally occupying Wall Street, like putting bodies on Wall Street, activist bodies, and being there presently. And it was really, there was a lot of outrage around Wall Street and the big banks being bailed out, why other people completely lost their homes, lost their retirement funds, lost their jobs, but somehow these big banks were, like I said, they were totally bailed out of the crisis and were given millions upon millions of dollars. And a lot of that money goes to salaries. It's not as if those millions of dollars then somehow trickle down to the regular person. And so Occupy Wall Street was, people were pissed about the economic system. People were outraged of capitalism and how capitalism destroys people's lives and the earth. But the earth wasn't as big of an issue at Occupy. That's why we created the Environmental Solidarity Working Group, because, you know, we needed to orient, or we wanted to orient the movement towards something that was more earth-based, because we knew that there was no wealth on a dead planet. There was no economy on a dead planet. There were no jobs on a dead planet. So only looking at the economic crisis through one lens really was way too narrow to be understanding this massive issue. But again, you know, back what, this was almost 10 years ago now, the ecological crisis that we're in, that we were in 10 years ago, it just wasn't something that people were as interested in as they are now. It wasn't something that was in the New York Times every day. And so, yeah, Occupy was this amazing movement, short-lived, but very powerful for me. And if anybody's been in downtown Manhattan by Wall Street, you know, there's a lot of sky rises, and there was this park called Zuccotti Park, which was the main hub. And it's like this, you know, this kind of, I don't think it was, you know, mostly concrete park. It wasn't like a park with grass, because it's, you know, downtown Manhattan. But so it was this big park, and people were there, and they were communicating, and they were eating together, and they were organizing for political movements, and they were, you know, organizing protests. And so it was just so much energy and so much excitement, and leading protests throughout the street was really, yeah, it was really an incredible, incredible moment.
So it sounds Occupy Wall Street, the catalyst for it, was based on circumstances that it looks like we're basically repeating, or will very likely repeat in the near future. Do you think that we're going to see another widespread national media attention movement like Occupy Wall Street as a result of the economic downfall caused by COVID-19?
It's a great question, Callie, and I absolutely think we're going to be seeing a lot of uprising because of this current situation that we're in with COVID-19 and the economic crash. I think that, you know, I don't know if it'll be a centralized movement like Occupy, or if it will be many, many decentralized movements like the climate justice movement. It'll be really interesting to see how people respond to this time. But I definitely think with more and more people losing their jobs and more people losing financial stability, that there will be a lot of people having more time to take to the streets, having more time to really fight for their human, basic human rights. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot of, yeah, a lot of organizing and movement building that comes out of this time.
Now, to pivot back to the work that you're doing, I'm sure we'll get back into more current events later on. How would you describe the work that you're doing?
So I run an organization called For the Wild, and it is, you could, if you imagine it like an umbrella, what fits under the For the Wild umbrella is our podcast, which we interview folks in the environmental, social, and climate justice movements, and really speak to the intersections of basically how all of this stuff relates to one another. And it's really important for us to do that, because if we care about the environment and environmental justice, we have to care about social justice and climate justice, because one without the other, we can't protect one without the other. And so we really go into that in the podcast, which is beautiful. And we speak with thought leaders and philosophers and religious leaders and indigenous leaders and just all sorts of incredible people that I feel really blessed and grateful to have gotten to converse with, and I've learned so much from them. And then we also have our 1 Million Redwoods Project, which is a hands in the dirt project. It's not just media, it's reforestation of the temperate rainforest regions of North America. And you could imagine if you took a strip from Northern California all the way up to Southeast Alaska, that is where the temperate rainforest region is. And we have been kind of creating like a Noah's Ark of species here at the Native Species Nursery that we've been building. So we've been really focusing on plants that are going extinct or are threatened or highly endangered. And we've been working with local community members, because something that's really important to us is to not fall into the trap of a reforestation industrial model, or because just like anything else, planting trees can be done with a lot of integrity and a lot of community building. Also, planting trees and plants can be done in a really industrialized way that uses a lot of toxic chemicals to grow the trees and a lot of toxic chemicals to even spray on the land before the trees are planted. There's questions around what trees are being planted. What's the genetic diversity? Are they even native plants to that area? And so our project, it is about planting plants, of course, but it's also really questioning the process by which we have been reforesting for the last, let's say, 50 years, and really challenging that and saying, you know, we're at a point where we can't do business as usual. Business as usual is killing the planet. We need to stretch beyond the ways that we've been working, and we need to really question the techniques, because it's not going to help us to use techniques that are extremely consumptive in their use of resources from the, you know, fossil fuel industry. You know, using machines, using plastic, absorbent amounts of plastic, using petrochemicals to fertilize, you know, all of that stuff is totally out the window for us, because we don't want to keep the machine going in the way it is, and we want to do good work. Now, what I'll say about that too is there's no way for me to fully get around using fossil fuels at all in the nursery. And I really, really wish there was. And I have tried to think and find ways to be as low tech as possible. So it's not about this project being some type of perfect non-resource using project. That is a dream that I would love to get to, but we're not there. But what I am really interested in is doing as least amount of harm as possible when it comes to trying to help the earth. And it takes us a bit longer. It definitely makes us have to research a bit more, probably a lot more. But I think it's really worth it in the long run, because also not only do I not want to be doing projects that prop up business as usual, I don't want to be having our community be looking to us and say, well, For the Wild's doing it that way, so we should. I want to be an example to get away from that kind of extractive model that has been industry's way of doing business. So that's the 1 Million Redwoods Project, and it's so beautiful now that it's spring. I've been able to work with the plants a lot more and do cuttings, and we have hundreds of varieties of plants growing right now, and it's so beautiful and really exciting. And then beyond that, we've been working in Alaska in the Tongass National Forest to end old growth logging, which is something that feels so dear to my heart, because I am completely in love with old growth forests. And just to explain what that is for those folks who may not know, so many of our forests, up to 98%, have been logged. And what I mean by logged is they've gone into these forests and they've completely taken the trees out. They've done something called clear cuts, where there are no trees left and it's just bare soil. And, you know, so much of old growth, meaning like the first trees, not, well, I don't want to say the first trees, but what I want to say, well, sometimes the first trees in those areas for sure, but trees that, forests that have been there before colonization. And so much has been clear cut, and then have been replanted or have grown back naturally. And sometimes, and then a lot of times those trees or forest are clear cut as well, because the logging industry is just trying to make money off these trees. But yeah, for me to imagine, and which is what's happening right now, is up in Alaska in the Tongass National Forest, which is our largest national forest, they are logging the last remaining old growth trees on our public lands with our taxpayer dollars, because old growth logging industry is so, it's so not profitable that we literally have to pay, we have to subsidize the logging of these trees with our taxpayer dollars. It's total insanity. It doesn't make sense at all. So I've been working with community organizers up in Alaska to help keep a protection in place called roadless rule, meaning that, you know, you can't build more roads in the Tongass and you can't log more of the old growth. And that's a project really dear to my heart. And I made a film called When Old Growth Ends. And then I'll say the last project that feels like one of the bigger projects we're working on is the Copper River Delta project with the EAC Preservation Council. And it's this amazing delta, river delta. It's 3 million acres. It's glacial rivers and fed by glaciers and moose and salmon and moss. And it's just stunning. And there are mountains within this delta that have coal. And so the Korean Alaskan Development Corporation want to blow these mountains up, like mountaintop removal, and which would destroy the whole ecosystem to extract coal. And so we are working with the EAC Preservation Council to purchase this area and put it back into Native Land Conservancy. So this land goes into Native hands, which would be such a miraculous project if we can pull it off, which I believe we absolutely can. So yeah, that's a bit about what we're up to.
And with regards to the 1 million redwood project, you were talking about biodiversity. Is the goal to someday plant 1 million redwoods? Or are you looking to plant a variety of different plants? Are you keeping them focused on where you're at? Or are you intending to plant throughout that entire Lake California Alaskan range?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm sure we will plant millions of trees over the span of the project, since it's a lifelong project. But we're not just focusing on trees, and we're not just focusing on redwoods. We will be planting redwoods. We'll be planting the other trees that grow alongside redwood, which is chinkapin, Douglas fir, tan oak, live oak, Pacific yew, madrone, you know, the list goes on and on. And so we'll be also working with those trees. And then of course there's the understory plants. There's manzanita and huckleberry and Oregon grape. Oh my gosh, the list goes on and on. I could spend probably an hour just listing off these species that I love so much. So in certain regions, we'll be planting out a certain assemblage of different plants based off what that region needs. Now, there are possibilities too, which we have started with this one project for assisted migration, which is an idea that with climate change, it's going to change the weather patterns of these ecosystems so drastically that, let's just say, redwoods may not be able to survive in their historical range. And so what if we helped move redwoods north where they'll be getting more fog and more rain? So we did a redwood planting project up in northern Washington. And so in some projects, we will be depending on the landowners we're working with, we will be moving some southern species north. And other times we'll be really focusing on the species of that exact watershed. But it's so project by project, and really listening to the land, learning from the land, learning from the people who have lived there for a long time, and taking into consideration what the community is wanting. So there's a lot of different facets to each planting project to really understand what is the need for that area specifically.
And you were also talking about the library that you're cultivating, and I'd love to know more about the details of that and what the intention is and what the long-term goal is.
Yeah, so to grow out all these trees and understory plants, we need a home for them and a nursery. And so what I was kind of speaking to earlier about the 1 million redwoods project and resource use, while we're building out this nursery, which we've been doing for the last few years, that's where my questioning around, like, how much plastic do we use in the nursery? Do we use plastic pots? Do we, and I don't want to. So, I mean, these are things that I've worked through, but just to give you a sense of connecting it back to what I was talking earlier. But yeah, so this living library, native species nursery, this Noah's Ark, these are just words that I kind of interchange to speak about the same thing, is this about 5-acre plot that has ponds and swales, and we're creating a very unique nursery that's taking a lot of different ideas from different schools of thoughts. Like, there's permaculture design that is implemented into the nursery, and there's water saving techniques that are implemented, and it's very artistic, but it's also very efficient. Like, for instance, we're not using plastic pots, because not only do I not want to put plastic pots into the more, you know, into the waste stream, but also when you water a small black plastic pot, the water evaporates very quickly. And so you have to use more water to keep those seedlings or the little plants that you're growing moist. But we're making in-ground pots that, one, you don't have to water as much. I don't have to use plastic for them. And also, when I water these plants in the ground, it's actually recharging the groundwater as well. And so I'm always looking for techniques like that in the nursery that are doing, it's like, what is that, feeding multiple birds with one hand. And so I'm always looking for those methods that we can be supporting the ecosystem that the nursery is in. We can be supporting the plant. We could be supporting water. We could be supporting the earth in a larger sense by not using resources that are extracted from somebody else's backyard and then trucked into ours. So there's so many pieces of that. I don't know if that totally answers your question, but that's at least a start.
Yeah, and I'm also curious, how do you predict your work and your organization as a whole as being affected by the current COVID-19 situation?
Yeah, well, I think a lot remains to be seen. A lot will, I think, unfold and show itself in especially the upcoming month or two. But in a way, how my work has been affected so far is strangely positive. And what I mean by that, and now this is just one facet, and I'll get into other facets, but in a sense, COVID has really canceled so many things that it has, in a beautiful way, forced me to just really focus on what's in front of me and the projects of For the Wild. Like before, I used to do a lot of live events, and strangely enough, I actually canceled all my live events in December and January of this year before the COVID outbreak happened. So I think I had a premonition that I needed to stay home and I needed to really focus and slow down. And so COVID is forcing many of us to slow down. And for some people, obviously, that's completely detrimental. For me, because so much of my work is online, I am not as affected by it in that way yet. And so far, it's been such an amazing lesson to me about how to slow down, how to focus, how to have boundaries, how to say no, how to not spread myself so thin. Because I know for me personally, through my journey, I've felt so much fear and guilt and shame and sadness around what's happening to the earth that I really just pushed myself to the extreme in every way I could. And I tried to do as much as I could, where now I feel like what's happening for me is something this time is telling me, keep doing a lot. It's not to say stop doing things, but be very intentional, be very focused, take your time, slow down. Don't rush, don't make decisions out of urgency. And so in a sense, COVID has helped me really reinstate those values. Now, I'll say, you know, so in terms of also, well, how do I say this? In terms of the media work still gets to chug along because I work remotely with people. Now, our media work, we're trying to, in a way, center it a little bit differently right now, just to respond to what's happening, because I want the community to feel supported. But kind of, you know, ironically, or maybe not ironically isn't the right word, but when you look back at our anthology of our podcast for the last 5-6 years, we've been talking about things like this for the last 5 or 6 years. We've had so many episodes on confronting crisis and things that we're up against. So we're not exactly really changing what we're doing. We're just really being that much more clear and intentional with what we're putting out there. Now, in terms of how COVID will affect the nursery project, I'm working on the nursery, and I have a few people here who I've been quarantining with who are continuing to work on the nursery. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how we're able to plant out this year if we can't really meet with landowners or work with them in a face-to-face way. Maybe it's like we're going to be planting trees 10 feet apart from each other, you know, and I don't know exactly. These are so many questions that we have to ask ourselves of how do we continue doing the work? How do we continue organizing and also slow down? Because when we slow down, the earth gets to rest. The more resources that we need, the more resources that need to be extracted from earth, meaning the more pipelines that need to get built, the more resource extraction projects need to happen to dig up the materials for us to do all of the stuff we want to do. So it's a really strong lesson to reprioritize and use what we need and not be so frivolous with all the things that we have access to. So hopefully that answers you, but I'm not sure if I got to the point.
What lessons do you hope that our governments take away from confronting the coronavirus outbreak that you would hope that they would apply or at least learn from in how we should be handling the climate crisis?
Gosh, it's a hard question to answer, because I don't think that our current administration is going to learn from this crisis. So this is going to be more of maybe a future hope of what governments could do, maybe other governments other than our own. I think we absolutely need to move away from fossil fuels. And I'm hoping that governments see that the Corona crisis is not a separate issue. It's connected to climate change. It's connected to capitalism. It's connected to globalization and travel. All of these things are very intertwined with one another. And so my hope is that governments go, holy moly, like, we can't go on business as usual. We really have to change the way that we lead in the future, because, you know, obviously we're in a crisis right now. Now, what if the hurricanes hit? What if big, what if droughts, which are happening already, you know? So let's just say you have natural disasters on top of a society that's already suffering from COVID, then we know that those natural disasters are going to hit even harder. And they're going to be even more challenging for people to move through. And it's going to be even more challenging for people to get the basic needs that they will need in order to move through natural disasters. So hopefully the government will see, whoa, this COVID-19 is a wake-up call that we really need to be much better prepared to take care of our people in terms of medical, housing, and just economics in general. The fact that people are not being able to pay rent after being out of work just a week or two, that is a huge sign that things aren't right here. If people are so close to living on the edge of economic stability, we need to look at that and say, okay, government, what are you going to do about that? How are you going to support people in living, eating, childcare, their health? You know, these are things that I feel like are really sloppy in this country, and they're not figured out. And we're seeing that. The COVID-19 crisis is highlighting all the ways that we are not prepared, and we're very we're not focusing on things that should be our priorities. We're focusing, like this government at least, is focusing really just on making money for the people who already have a lot of it. So yeah, I think that's a huge thing to push right now to our government, is we need to be more prepared and we need to take care of our people much better. And I think, though, in a sense, like, let's just say we can't rely on our government to change, which we haven't been able to for a long time, that we need to take it upon ourselves and our local communities to be more resilient. We need to create our own grassroots organizations to take care of each other, to support food security, to support clean water security. And if we do that as a community, then if crisis hits, we're going to know that we have each other, and we're going to know that the people who care about us, who live in our community, have already thought through what may happen and will be resourced to handle what comes at them. Relying on a big federal government, I don't think is the safest bet. I think we can push the government. I think we can support politicians who we believe in, who will really fight for us as humans, and more than humans, the ecological aspect, to fight for the earth. But let's just say that, you know, for the next at least few months, while we still have this current administration, that we'll probably not get what we want in the long run. So I think, again, let's go local. Let's go to our communities that are right next to us, that we can touch, that we can, well, we can't do that right now, but we can talk to, we can start to organize, so that we're not totally reliant on governments to take care of us, because I think that always is going to put us in a vulnerable position.
If you had the opportunity to stand in front of a room of 5,000 passionate, earth-loving people, what message would you want to pass on?
I'd want to pass on maybe something like, now is the time to really stand in our love, in our passion, in our power. Now is the time to fight to take down dams. Now is the time to stop the pipelines. Now is the time to get ready and to fight really hard and to stand where you love and not give up. There's so much that we're up against, but the more of us who say yes to the call, the more of us who allow ourselves to totally fall in love with this earth, the better off we'll be. We need everybody that we can get to be a part of this movement. And we need people of all different types who have all different types of interests and skills and offerings and gifts. And I think the more people we get involved who are really living into their passion, the stronger we'll be, and the more likely we'll be able to really stop these resource extraction projects like the tar sands, like offshore oil drilling, like old growth logging, or logging in general. You know, we're seeing through this COVID thing is like, we don't need all the things that we thought we needed. It's not necessary to have all of these creature comforts and conveniences and access to Amazon.com whenever we want for crap that we don't even need, that we'll probably throw away in a month or two. That stuff is killing the planet, and we don't need it. What we need is relationships with each other, relationships with ourselves, relationships to the earth. And so we need to really hone right now on the places we love, fighting for them, organizing, building community, and not giving up. And knowing that I think we have the best chance right now that we've had in a long time to actually make big change. Because before, I didn't think people would change. I didn't think that it was possible for people to stop flying or to do these things. But what we're seeing is that it's absolutely possible. And we don't need it. So I think right now we are in a place, in a time where we actually have so much opportunity to make big changes. And so go for it. And I'm not saying rush, and I'm not saying let's do it out of urgency, but I'm just saying now is the time. Let's really focus. Let's really get connected, and let's make the world that we want to live in, because we can do that.
I love that. Let's make the world that we want to live in. And I feel like we are on the brink of something. I feel like there is a very deep awakening, and those words, I love them. That resonated with me. The work you do is just so inspiring and incredible, and I love it. And I want to know how my listeners can support the work you're doing, whether it's supporting potentially the 1 Million Redwoods Project, or supporting reforestation efforts within their local communities. What advice or resources that you have?
Wow. Well, gosh, thank you so much for asking that question. And yeah, if people want to support our work, they can go on to forthewild.world, which is our website, and you can make a donation. You can become a patron through our Patreon and donate to the podcast in that way. You can sign up for our newsletter on our website, forthewild.world, to just be in the know and keep in touch. We're also on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. And then if you want to reach out to us directly because you have a question, you want to be involved in a project, you want us to know about something you're doing, you can email us at connect@forthewild.world, and we get back to everybody that emails us in. So that emails us in our inbox. So yeah, you please feel free to do that. And otherwise, in terms of other resources, our website is full of resources under each of our podcasts. So if we're talking about plastics, if we're talking about, pipeline protest, if we have episodes on the spiritual aspect of climate change, we have so many different topics. You can go to our website and find more resources if you want to learn more about any of these topics on each of the podcast episode pages.
So thank you so much, Ayana, for coming on the show today. And where can we go to learn more about you and supporting the work that you're doing?
Well, you can head over to forthewild.world. You can find us on social media through Instagram, which is where we're mostly on, but of course, Facebook and Twitter. And then you can subscribe on iTunes or Spotify or anywhere you get podcasts to For the Wild podcast, or you can listen through our website, or you can email us at connect@forthewild.world.
And that's a wrap. I'll be back next Wednesday with an episode about ethical investing that I can't wait to share with you. If you know someone who'd enjoy the Hippie Haven podcast, share it with them or share it on social media. If you post on Instagram, don't forget to tag and follow me at Hippie Haven Shop. This podcast is produced with the help of my communication coordinator, Ray Lynn, who also runs our Hippie Haven Facebook group, which if you haven't already joined, definitely hop over to Facebook, search Hippie Haven in the Groups tab, and join our private community of fellow hippies trying to make a difference in our communities. You can also support our work here at Hippie Haven by leaving a review for the podcast in whichever app you're using to listen, or you can buy us a virtual cup of coffee to keep us going. Visit buymeacoffee.com/hippiehaven to support the work we do with just $4. Thank you so much for spending this time with me. I hope you have a great rest of your day, and go wash your hands.